Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of our program, Dare to be Different. It's just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming, Medium Wave 1548 Satellite Islam, and on the DSTV Bouquet 826. And we've had some lovely weather. You know, autumn has definitely settled in, and the nights are getting colder, and the mornings definitely chillier. And this morning we've got a wonderful, wonderful guest, and we're going to do something different, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Melissa Whitecross. Hi, good morning, Dr. Melissa.
Hi there, how are you doing? Good morning to you and your listeners.
Thank you very much. And Melissa, before we continue, tell us something about yourself.
So I work for the NGO Red Life South Africa. I'm one of their conservation scientists, and I have been involved in the Blacktail Festival that was recently at the Johannesburg Zoo, and that's really a festival where we celebrate conservation of wetlands and the water birds that live in these wetlands.
When you talk about a conservationist scientist, tell us a little bit about that.
So my main role is to research different birds that live in South Africa, particularly birds that are threatened, so the likes of your southern banded snake eagle, the tailor falcon, which is one of our critically endangered birds here in South Africa, and also the white-winged flufftail, which is the bird that the festival is actually named after. The white-winged flufftail is a critically endangered bird globally. There's an estimate of around 250 of these birds left in the wild. So that really is very, very low numbers, and we're very concerned about their survival. So we're working to try and save these wetland specialist birds that are only found in the high-altitude wetlands here in South Africa and in Ethiopia.
Now, when you say they only found you in the high altitude cells, would that be somewhere in Gauteng or not?
So there are historical reports from the south of Gauteng near Sekerbosch Rand, but the main areas that these birds are found in are along the Drakensberg Escarpment chain. So near Dullstroom, there's an area called Middelpunt Wetland, where a lot of our research is held, but it's basically that Dullstroom area and down towards Buckerstroom. And there's a suspicion that we might find them down towards Nsekeni. So there's very, very high altitude mountainous wetlands.
And when we talk about them being endangered, what's the difference of being endangered and just something that we've got to conserve?
So the term endangered really comes from a group called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is the IUCN. And they developed a list called the Red List. And they basically categorize animals based on how many individuals are left in the wild, how big their distributions are, how likely they are to go extinct is really the cause for that index. And so something that is critically endangered is something that has a very high likelihood of going extinct in the next few decades. So that's an animal that you really need to keep tabs on and put a lot of effort into conserving. This is something which is endangered, which definitely has shown population declines or declines in its range over the last couple of years, but is not necessarily on the brink of extinction just yet. And then you get a term which is vulnerable, so that's slightly less threatened than the other two categories.
Now, when we talk about this particular bird, that would be the flufftail.
Yes.
Is there any likelihood of getting them in our gardens?
And so it's probably unlikely that you'll get one in your gardens. These birds are really, really specialized to these wetland habitats. So they move through these wetlands and between wetlands. They really know where they're going. So it's unlikely that you'll get them in your garden. But their sort of cousin species, which is your red-chested flufftail, there's a very good chance that people in Gauteng could see those in their gardens, or if they live near a wetland, they'll probably more likely hear them than see them. They're quite secretive little birds that tend to stick in the dense vegetation.
And are they migratory?
So our theory right now is that they are. We only find the white-winged flufftail here in South Africa in the summer months, and during the Ethiopian summer, which they're going into now in the northern hemisphere, that's when these birds are found in Ethiopia. So the suspicion right now is that they are migratory, but we're doing a lot more research currently to try and figure out exactly where our birds are going, whether they're making it all the way to Ethiopia or whether they might be migrating somewhere more coastal between the two areas.
You know, just when you hear the name flufftail, you know, it seems to be a very small bird, something that you could cuddle and hold.
Is that So it is a very small bird. If you sort of put your hand out in front of you and picture a little bird that fills your palm, that's about how big these birds are. So they really are not very big birds at all. And I think if you cuddled one, they'd probably freak out. But the name does sound very cuddly, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was just thinking, would you one with lots of white feathers? I haven't seen one. I'm just trying to, for our listeners and myself,
Yes.
Picture them. Would it be white? Would it be cuddly? You know, would it be something fluffy? I'm not sure because the name Fluff Tails is fluffy. I'm not sure.
Yes. So their tails are quite fluffy. But they're quite a streamlined little bird. If you picture almost the Afrikaans name for them is a vleikaken, which translates to a marsh chicken. So they sort of look like a very small streamlined chicken. But I wouldn't say that they are very cuddly animals.
I'm just trying to, fluff tail and, that type of thing and conjure for our listeners what if, and the colors that you'd get, would it be just a one-colored bird? Is it a multicolored bird?
And so it's got a few colors on it. They have this really beautiful chestnut burgundy red head. And that's in sort of the head and chest is red. Underneath they're a bit more pale, sort of a grayish white. On their backs they're quite dark brown with a few white flecks. And in their wings, when they open up their wings, they've got dark brown wings with these two white patches in the wings. And that's where their name comes from, the white-winged flufftail, with these two white patches at the bases of their wings. And then they have a beautiful little red fluffy tail that I mentioned earlier.
So when we're looking at, whilst you say that they're confined to the wetlands, what about, their food and so forth? Would it all be something that they find within the wetlands?
Yes, so that's something that we're still trying to figure out. We've got a series of camera traps that we've put out in these wetlands to try and figure out exactly what these birds are eating. But it's likely that they're probably feeding on little invertebrates and insects that live in the wetland, and pretty much everything that they need to survive is found in these wetlands. So there's really no reason for them to be anywhere else other than in these wetlands.
And like you said, it's a diminishing population. I was looking at some of the stats that you've got that you could put them in a bathtub. That's the amount
Yes.
we have, internationally.
Yes, so if you took the entire population and you sort of stacked them all inside one bathtub, with our current estimates, that's pretty much how many we think are still out there in the wild, which is very concerning that you could fit a whole population in such a small space.
Now, when we're talking about, these birds, now, whilst they're confined to the wetlands, there's lots of other birds that will be confined to the wetlands as well. Is that correct?
So the wetlands are quite a unique habitat. For your listeners who don't know what a wetland is, it's essentially an area where water congregates and you get either a layer of water forming underneath the vegetation or you find vegetation that is adapted to really live in these wet environments. So just as the vegetation was adapted to these wet environments, we find some animals and birds that are adapted to also live in these wet environments. So certain birds like your jacanas or your moorhens, the coots, red-knobbed coots will be found in wetlands, and the more sort of skulky birds, you get a bird called a rail, which is a beautiful gray and blue bird with this red beak that moves between the reeds, and you'll occasionally hear them calling out in the wetland, but you don't often see them.
And, once you do sometimes drive out, out of Johannesburg, and you get to the, wetlands, you find some of the flamingos and heron. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So those are your very charismatic species that people probably know best. You'll get your greater and lesser flamingos here in Johannesburg. And you have loads of different ducks that also occur there, from your yellow-billed duck, Egyptian geese, and you get a little, lots of different duck species.
Now, Melissa, when we talk about, wetlands, we've got one just on our doorstep that's out in Indonesia. Whilst we do have listeners for, around the country, maybe they also have wetlands. We have huge challenges around our wetlands. Number one is that people don't appreciate our wetlands. Number two, we seem to have, an invasion of people that have taken over some of the, the peat from the wetlands, the soil from the wetlands. And in other areas, we find that, our housing developments have sprung up around these wetlands. Tell us, take us to some of those things.
Yes, so I'm glad that you mentioned the peat. Peat is a very special soil type. It's an organic fuel that consists of spongy material that's formed from partially decomposed organic matter, which is mostly from the wetland plants that occur above the soil layer, particularly in the wetlands. And something that a lot of people might not realize is that peat is one of the first steps in the formation of coal. So it is a very important soil type, and they tend to only occur in these wet environments. And the really important thing with peat is that it allows the wetland to have a spongy quality, and that spongy quality really allows wetlands to filter water as it moves through. And one of the services that wetlands provide for people that a lot of people might not know is that as water flows into a wetland, the wetlands actually act like a natural filter. And so when that water moves out of the wetland again, that water has actually been filtered by the wetland system and is a lot purer than it was coming in. So these wetlands not only provide water storage, but they also provide water water filtration, which is really important for us. And what people might not know is that currently between 30-60% of high-fault peatlands, which is about 6% of the known peatlands in South Africa, have already been exploited for peat. So we're looking at over half of our peatlands being already destroyed. And that's one of the key issues with wetland conservation, is that these wetlands are being drastically affected by not only mining, but agriculture, draining for development, and repurposing for cattle grazing or agriculture.
We also have, you know, a unique situation where some of these, you know, the peat is removed and it's sold to gardeners. What should gardeners do, and how should they, you know, react to that?
So there's a lot of alternatives to peat that you get in our wetlands, and I think a lot of people don't realize that peat is actually able to be bought in from other sources, not just our natural wetlands here. So it's not necessary to actually go and take it out of our natural systems where it is needed. There are peat producers worldwide who have a surplus of peat that we could rely on to come in. And peat's really used industrially right now in the mushroom industry and some of the other more horticultural industries. So there are alternatives to our natural wetland peat, and I'd encourage people to really look into trying to source those rather than just taking peat directly out of our wetlands.
What's the difference between peat and bog?
Not going to be able to answer that question, sadly. But I assume that your bog is really the area that you'll find peat in.
I wasn't too sure because, you know, when you look in the UK, they always refer to it as bog, and, you know, when you look at it, you find a lot of the peat. So I was wondering if there was that type of association.
Yeah. No, I'd say it's probably the bog is area where you will find peat.
That's fine. Now, Melissa, when we look at all of these things and we find that, you know, people are now, like you said, it's not just agricultural land, but it's also, you know, development for homes and so forth. But South Africa is also, you know, signatory to the Ramsar Agreement. Is that correct?
Correct, it is, yes.
So the Ramsar Agreement then does say that everyone, you know, that the wetlands are a protected space of land, and the government and the agencies that are working with that should do everything to protect that.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Ramsar sort of full title is the Convention on Wetlands of International Importance, especially as waterfowl habitat. So it came about to protect mainly water birds, but in doing so, they've really tried to look after these habitats where these birds occur, which are these wetlands. And it came into force in 1975, and worldwide we're looking at approximately 980 wetlands, which is over 70 million hectares that have been designated as Ramsar sites. So that's a lot of area, which is great, but even though these declarations have been made, some of those Ramsar wetlands are not necessarily protected just by that treaty. It really takes people on the ground valuing the area, protecting it, using it, and ensuring that it adds natural value to the area for everyone that lives around it.
And when you're talking about, you know, again, let's go back to the wetlands. There's a number of things that it impacts upon. For example, it's nature's big green cleaning machine. Tell us about that.
Yes, no, it absolutely is. So I mentioned earlier that these wetlands filter the water as it's coming through, and they How it essentially works is wetlands are formed with layers of different soil types, and that can range from tiny granular soils all the way up to big rocks filtered throughout the system. And that in conjunction with a very dense vegetation layer. So there's different types of plants that you find in these wetlands, from what we call sedges, which is a bit like a grass, to Phragmites reeds, which are your big, tall, spiky reeds that a lot of your listeners might be familiar with. And you also get this combination of sedges and reeds work together to really filter out, as the water moves through, it extracts the different dirt particles and the chemicals by taking them up into the vegetation. And as that water moves through, it then gets purified and also slowed down. So as this water flows into the wetland, it'll be coming in a lot quicker than it leaves. And that helps to reduce flooding risks and really does provide a lot more services than just cleaning.
So do you think that some of the flooding, you know, and that we've seen in recent years out in Gauteng and perhaps in other parts, is perhaps due to the, destruction of the wetlands?
So I think it could definitely be linked to it. I wouldn't say that it's the absolute cause. As you'll know, if you look around any big city, a lot of our natural green areas have been replaced with hard concrete surfaces, and so you get a lot of runoff from that. Whereas if there's a more natural layer, such as a grassland or a wetland, the water is then able to infiltrate into that soil rather than just running off. And that's the reason that we're seeing a lot of flooding, particularly through Joburg, I think. But if we can get our wetlands back up to scratch, hopefully that'll assist with at least some of the flooding in certain areas that have been affected.
And when we look at, you know, the wetlands, like you said, it's good. You know, it has multifaceted. There's so many things that would. I'm just trying to, you know, it's not just about protection of the birds and perhaps smaller animals, but there's a lot of other spin-offs for us as human beings.
Yes, absolutely. And one of those is just having a natural space to go out and enjoy. I know there's a wetland not too far from where you guys are called Marievale. And that's a wetland that I often frequent. It's run by Gauteng Parks, and it's a beautiful area just to go for the day and really immerse yourself in this beautiful green natural environment. As you mentioned earlier, there's flamingos floating around, otters swimming in the different little streams that you can see while you're there. And it really is just a fun day out. They've got a picnic site where you can take your family, have a nice lunch in a beautiful green space. And I'd really encourage your listeners to go out there and use this facility. It's free to get in, which is amazing considering that it is a park. And it's a great place to not only enjoy birds, there's dragonflies, different flowers. It's a beautiful space, and I'd really encourage people to get out there and enjoy it. And any of our natural areas really need to be enjoyed so that they can stay with us for a long time to come.
And just going to take us back, where is this particular site?
So Marievale is out just past Nigel. It's sort of in the southeast corner of Gauteng. And it's a beautiful big wetland system just outside of Nigel. And if you're traveling from sort of Johannesburg, it's probably a half hour's drive to get there. And it's well worth a visit. It's just to the east of Sekebosrand Nature Reserve.
You know, we also have our own wetlands on our doorstep. It's out in Indonesia. And the challenge we have is at the moment, there's a tussle between, you know, the Department of Housing and city parks. You know, it's been cited many, many years ago. It's been put under the control of the Department of Housing. And that is where,
yes,
you know, the problems stem from. So that we are not able to reclaim the space. And it's been neglected. And we know that there's a lot of soil that's been taken illegally. It's been mined. There's a lot,
yes,
of dump. You know, we have carcasses being dumped. So there's a lot of those things happening. How do you think that, you know, people of Indonesia should be, you know, interacting with this space?
I would definitely get your community leaders involved and absolutely try and approach whoever is in control of that area right now. As I said earlier, there's so many services that these wetlands provide to communities that are directly on their doorstep. And sadly, one of the problems with wetlands is that they are a catchment for whatever flows out of the area surrounding them. And so all sorts of litter and pollutants get rushed into these systems. And they really are the source of the water that we want to drink. So we can't drink water that's polluted and damaged. And it's really important that, these areas are really made to be more pristine. And so as a community, I would absolutely push to have that wetland either rehabilitated. As you said, it's been mined and disturbed. It is possible to rehabilitate these wetlands, so I would definitely encourage rehabilitation of what has been damaged, and whatever area is still left intact, work with the communities, teach people to value the wetland system, not only for visiting, but all of the natural ecosystem services that it does provide, and get in touch with whoever is managing that land and engage with them about the services that that wetland could be providing to you if it wasn't damaged or destroyed.
We do have a current, you know, small group of people, you know, enthusiasts who are trying very hard.
Yes.
Wetlands, and they've tried, and they're engaging with government, they're engaging with the municipality, and trying to sort of, you know, reclaim, like you said, to rehabilitate the space. And
yes.
And it serves three very big communities. It serves Soweto, El Dorado Park, and Indonesia. So, they,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
Maybe if this is rehabilitated, Melissa, it would, you know, be beneficial to all. And the challenge that we have is that we're still really struggling to get everybody to understand why this space needs to be rehabilitated, why we want it to be transferred from housing back to, Johannesburg City, you know, parks and so forth.
Yes.
I think it's an uphill battle, but I'm sure we'll get there one day.
Absolutely, and I wish them all the best of luck. It's never easy changing people's perceptions, but I think the benefits really do outweigh the cons, and I hope that through the engagement with those higher powers that they really can get them to see the light and see the value in natural systems.
We're going to go for a short break. When we come back, we'll continue stage. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We just tuned in. My name is Ismail Briyab. Our program Dare to be Different. And yes, this morning we are definitely being very different. And we're talking about the wetlands and birds. And this morning we've got a wonderful, wonderful guest, and that's Dr. Melissa Whitecross, and she is a, I'm just trying to get the correct term, she's a conservationist, am I right?
And is it correct.
And is it environmental conservationist?
Yes, that's correct.
And to those of you that are still cuddled in your beds, or some of you that are out in your garden, we've got this lovely, wonderful information coming through. While pure, it hasn't been specifically to our gardens, it has been about the environment, and now we're going to move on to some of the things that we can do in our gardens. Now, Melissa, let's go through, you know, it's that time of the year where food source will be scarce for birds. Do you think it's a good idea to be feeding birds?
Yes, so you're absolutely correct. We're going into winter now, and a lot of the natural food sources for our birds start to either dry up or disappear. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with feeding birds in your garden. As BirdLife South Africa, we do encourage people to be ethical in the way that they do feed birds. So when I say that, what I'm talking about is if you're going to put out things like fruit, seeds, that sort of thing, make sure that there's no pesticides on them, so give them a nice wash before you put them out. If you're going to use seeds, put them out, but if you're going, you have to either do two strategies. You've got to be a completely regular seed feeder, or you've got to be a very irregular seed feeder. And the reason that I say this is that birds can become very quickly habituated and trained to a food source. So if you're feeding them fairly regularly and then all of a sudden you stop, those birds will often just hang around waiting for their easy meal to come around, and they won't necessarily go out and forage, which can have an impact on their ability to then go out and actually find more food once your food's stopped. So if you are going to put out seeds, make sure that you sort of mix it up a bit so that they don't become too reliant on your food source, or be very dedicated and make sure that there's a good meal for them every single day, particularly as you go into the really, really cold periods.
Now, when looking at feed, you spoke about fruit, and what about, I know lots of people seem to take lots of breadcrumbs and rice and so forth. Is that a good idea?
So we discourage bread. The reason is that it absorbs a lot of water, and it can actually swell inside birds' crops. So birds aren't really designed to eat bread, but the odd crumb in that won't have too much of a negative impact on them. But I definitely say that seeds are a better food source for them. And any little fruit scraps and that sort of thing, if you don't have a compost heap, birds are pretty versatile. They'll definitely have a go at a bit of banana peel or that sort of thing if you're not going to finish it off.
And what about the rice? Would that be good enough?
Also discourage rice. similar to the bread. It swells when it gets wet. If it's already cooked rice, it's not the most ideal, but birds will be okay if they have a little bit of it. But we definitely would encourage mainly fruit, seeds, and your more sort of bird natural diets.
What about, you know, for plants that would attract birds into the garden in winter? Are there any very specific ones?
Yes. So there's actually been a phenomenal book that was brought out towards the end of last year by a gentleman called Duncan Butchart. And he specifically talks about growing indigenous gardens to attract birds. But this time of year, there's a plant called Leonotus, which some of you may have seen. It's a very tall plant with little what look like baubles on it as it goes up. And it's got these beautiful little orange flowers that stick out. I think a common name for it, a lot of people call it, is wild dacha. But it's this lovely Leonotus plant, and the sunbirds absolutely love it. They come through and they can drink nectar from these different balls along the stem. And as we start moving into the colder months now, your aloes will start to flower, which is a great food source not only for your nectarvores like your sunbirds, but weavers and orioles and other birds, even your bulbuls will take advantage of the nectar that's available through those plants.
We also have, you know, lots of queries about some of the birds becoming pest in the garden. For example, you know, the miner or perhaps the pigeons. Is there any way to discourage those?
For pigeons in particular, if you're putting out a lot of seed, they're very good opportunists. If they find a good seed source, they're going to be there. So if you find that you're getting a lot of pigeons in your garden, I would say stop putting seeds out for a while. They'll move off to another area, and then you can slowly start feeding. And the other alternative is to get pigeon-proof feeders. So you get little cages that smaller birds like your weavers and your sparrows can fit into, but your big pigeons can't get into. And that's a nice way of still feeding your garden birds without the pigeons being too much of a pest on top of that.
You know, if you've been watching some of the birds in the garden, which I normally do, and when the miners come in and the pigeons and the other smaller birds, and you sort of see these birds chasing the other birds away, and, you know, it's fascinating to watch that, but then you find that there isn't an adequate source, because by the time the smaller birds come in, the miners or the pigeons have eaten all the food.
Yeah, sadly your bigger birds are going to take on the sort of dominant role. You really just got to try and either stagger the way you feed. So if you find that you're putting out first thing and those bigger birds are coming through, you can either then put out a little bit later and hopefully the bigger birds will have moved off to another food source and your smaller birds can come through. Or you've got to just find ways of feeding the birds that limit what size of bird can actually access that food. So whether it's a tray that's got small holes that something like a sparrow could or a finch could fit through, that doesn't allow the miners or your bigger birds to get at that sort of food. Or you can make a totem pole. If you've got a nice stump in your garden, you can knock a nail into the side of it, and things like your crested barbets, which have toes that allow them to cling to the sides of trees, will then be able to eat that fruit, whereas your other perching birds, like a miner, might not necessarily be able to do that, and they then won't be able to reach that food source.
You know, you mentioned something about peels. Do birds take to peels? I'm just wondering, perhaps apples and pears and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the orange peels, banana peels. Would they eat it or wouldn't they?
So an orange peel, probably not. But if there's a bit of the sort of segments and stuff left inside the orange peel, they'll definitely go for that. Apple peels, pear peels, banana peels, if there's a bit of the flesh left inside, they will absolutely go for that. So if you've peeled those fruits and you find that there's a little bit of the fleshy part left on those peels, absolutely put them out. The birds will love that.
And again, you know, another question that always comes through is that some of these birds roost in the nest and they make a big mess. Is there a way to deter them?
So depending on what type of bird it is, there's different ways to deter them. And so if we go back to the pigeon example, you can get trellises for your roof tiles and that sort of thing to keep the pigeons off. But birds, being determined as they are, can often find ways around those trellises. So the best way to discourage birds hanging around your garden is to stop feeding them. But But if you have natural food sources, that's going to be a bit trickier. So it would really have to be treated on a case-by-case basis to deal with pest birds. But we do encourage people to contact us, and we're always happy to help guide people in how to ethically co-live with their feathered friends.
The other bird that seems to care, you know, create a challenge. You know, in the last couple of years, we've seen an invasion of I beg your pardon, of the hardedas. And, you know,
yes.
and some of them are actually scared because when they come in, you know, they seem to be a bit of a, I'm not sure if the description I'm giving reminds you a bit of a prehistoric, you know, a creature. So they come in and they make this loud noise and, and you're not too sure if they're going to come for you or they just find a way.
They're sort of a nickname, the Vuvuzela of the sky, very noisy birds. But the reason we've seen this massive explosion in hardedas is that back in the mid to late 80s, we had a very severe drought. And hardedas were originally more forest and lowland birds. And you found them up sort of in the northern parts of South Africa where there's more bushveld type habitat. And with that reduction in water, these birds started moving into the more built up areas where people had swimming pools and beautiful manicured lawns that they water, so the lawns stay nice and moist throughout the year. One of the biggest challenges for hardedas is that with the cold coming, the ground gets really, really hard and they're unable to feed properly. So here in Joburg in particular, we've got beautiful golf courses with soft lawns and lovely water sources and big trees for them to live in. So we've really created this hardedas niche, and the birds have done really, really well because of that. So, unfortunately, one of the byproducts of changing Joburg from a grassland into a forest is that we've created the perfect habitat for something like a hardedas to take advantage, and that they have done. But they're very friendly birds. They're not like your Egyptian geese that will actively chase you around. They tend to just move off, but they will announce their presence, as you've heard.
You know, I don't know. That's just a description. You know, it's sort of prehistoric, and I don't know if there's a correct description, but when you come in there, I think because of the sharp beak, would that be correct?
Yeah, it could be, yeah. I mean, so birds, those who do follow evolutionary trends, birds are shown to be related to dinosaurs, so not too far off the prehistoric, I guess.
You know, I was just thinking, because I see a lot of the hardedas and the mynas and, you know, the pigeons and all the other different birds. The other one that I found strange has been the woodpecker. Is that something that comes into Johannesburg? I saw a couple of them.
Yeah, so we've seen a big increase in birds such as your woodpeckers or your barbets, birds that we really call sort of canopy dwellers. So they're birds that live in trees or on trees. And with this increase in the planting of trees in Johannesburg over the last century, we've really created a lot of habitat for these birds to move into. So as birds are moving further and further south, out of the more sort of original wooded savannas of the north, we're seeing an increase in the likes of your woodpeckers and barbets and that sort of thing in Johannesburg, which if you're a bird watcher is fantastic because we're getting a lot more diversity than we used to have here.
What about the hoopoe?
So the hoopoe is one of my favorite birds, and I absolutely love them. And they tend to feed on your more sort of short, grassy plains. So they'd often come in after there'd been a fire in the grassland or that sort of thing. They don't like particularly tall grass. And once again, the reason that we get them so much in our gardens is that everyone keeps their grasses nice and short, and it really is just the ideal place for hoopoes to live.
Yeah, like I said, you know, I saw these, you know, a number of birds that we were not familiar with as we grew up, and now the hoop-hoop and the woodpeckers and all the others. So, you know, it's exciting, but you're just wondering about the habitats and what you need to know about and how you can attract them to the garden. Finally, before we wind up, what else do you think gardeners should be doing for birds at this time of the year?
So, this time of year, as I said, it's starting to get colder. If you are putting out water for them, make sure that you're keeping your water nice and clean. So rinse out those bird baths. We are going into what we call the dry season now, where it does get cold. Make sure that if you have any bushes that still have some leaves on them, that those leaves stay nice and intact, because that really does help insulate the birds when they're perching, and it helps stop any frost damage from getting towards them. If you do have food to spare, always put it out for the birds. I know they'll be most grateful, as will we, because it keeps them going through these cold months. And if you are someone who's partial to planting indigenous plants, we very much encourage people, not only from a water-wise point of view, indigenous gardens don't put as much of a strain on the water table as your exotics do. And those natural plants have evolved with the birds here, and so the birds will be able to use them to survive through the winter months.
Thank you very much. And you said if anyone has any queries with regards to birds, could you give us those contact details for BirdLife
yes,
South Africa?
Absolutely. So we are BirdLife South Africa. We're based in Dunkeld West in Johannesburg. And if people would like to get hold of us, they can contact our head office on 011-789-1122. And that's 011-789-1122. Or alternatively, they can also email info@birdlife.org.za.
011-789-1122.
Or that's correct.
Birdlife.org.za. And any queries with regards to birds, you'd be able to...
Yes, yeah. If someone's keen to get involved in the hobby of bird watching, if they have a question about birds, they're more than welcome to get in touch with us. We've got a great team of staff here who are always willing to help share their passion about birds.
Maybe we should be talking about bird watching the next time, but you take care. Thank you very much, Melissa. I've enjoyed it. And
thanks so much for having me.
You take care. Thanks a million.
Thanks. All the best. Cheers.
And that was Dr. Melissa Wykos giving us the importance of wetlands and its importance. And she's given us some insights into how we can assist our feathered friends in the gardens as well. It's all from me, and to meet again, inshallah. This is the last program, and we'll resume a day to be different after the month of Ramadan. Jazakallah khair. Request for du'as. Make du'a for us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept all your ibadah. Allah make it easy for everyone, and do make du'a for all of us here at the radio station. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.